The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Forgery, murder, religion, and the poet Emily Dickinson. These elements form the basis of a great yarn involving America's most celebrated and notorious forger, Mark Hoffman. The book is called The Poet and the Murderer. And the man who wrote the book is joining us now. Simon Worrell, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Good to hear you again.
Now, I've been reading your book, and it is a piece of forensic analysis, the like of which I have rarely come across. So we'll stick with the generalities and tell us, first of all, about Mark Hoffman, born a Mormon, but kind of not for long.
Yeah, well, Mark Hoffman is born in 1951. He's a very kind of geeky kid. You know, he wears a blazer and glasses. He has an IQ of 169. He's very brilliant. He's brought up as a Mormon, but he begins to have questions about the religion and some of its claims. And these are just knocked back down. You know, his father could be compared to a very strict Catholic or Protestant or whatever religion, but a very authoritarian, strict father who simply won't have any questions and smashes him back down any times he raises an issue about the religion and its credibility, because of course it's a very new religion, Mormonism, with very little proof, and so that gradually turns him against the Mormon religion, and he's the first person to ever try to use forged manuscripts to try to bring down a major world religion.
Now, obviously, the Church of the Latter-day Saints is still going strong, but I must say, when I read your book and the history of Mormonism and Joseph Smith and his tales of gold plates, which no one has ever seen, and how an angel gave him binoculars to allow this barely literate man to read ancient Egyptian, I mean, it beggars belief.
It beggars belief. It's absolutely nuts. But I suppose, you know, if Christianity was a newer religion and we were still not used to it, we'd say, well, you know, an angel comes down and, you know, there's an immaculate conception and he turns wine into water. Who can believe any of this? So, like all religions, they require sort of willing suspension of disbelief. I think Hazlitt called that the definition of theatre or the necessity for theatre. So, but it is an absolutely nutty, nutty tale, and complete, as you say, with, they weren't quite binoculars. They were more like sort of high power reading glasses, so he could decipher this mumbo jumbo. I mean, it was all invented and none of it was true. And of course, because it was a new religion and because it had this kind of strange and weird and fabulous invented story about it, it was desperate. The Mormon Church at the time that Mark Hoffman started to deal with them, it was desperate for documentation that would authenticate its claims. And so Mark Hoffman, brilliant forger, master of paper, ink, you name it, what, handwriting. He could put himself in a trance and do different handwritings. Friend remembers being at a cafe in New York and he took out one of those drawing things they put for kids, and there he was doing George Washington, Daniel Boone, Mark Twain, one signature after another. So he began to sell them forgeries completely turned there. Well, initially, actually, this was the diabolically clever person. Initially, he sold them documents that authenticated their religion, some of them genuine, because he was a well-known documents dealer in America, and specifically Mormon documents. So having suckered them in, and he was by then dealing with the president of the Mormon Church, this is the equivalent of the Pope, he began to sell them these documents that turned their theology upside down, as though, let's say, you know, a document was discovered that was a letter from Christ referring to Mary Magdalene as a prostitute.
So effectively, he sold them genuine stuff. As a document dealer, he found these things, but then he started to forge both stuff that was favourable to the religion and then the embarrassing stuff, which was not favourable to their religion. So they felt they had to buy it to basically keep it secret.
They did. They bought things that they then stuck in a safe immediately, never to see the light of day. But Hoffman, you know, as I said, he was diabolically clever and took an almost sadistic pleasure, it has to be said, in deceiving the Mormons and really inflicting harm on them, hurting them badly. So not only did he do that, but he knew that they would lock them away. And so he would contact the LA Times, for instance, and tell them about this document that the church has just bought, which had locked away. So suddenly the LA Times is calling the church saying, can you confirm that you have this document such and such that you just bought?
Now, did the church ever discover his wrongdoing? I mean, did they ever suss out that they were actually the victims of major fraud and counterfeiting?
Well, it all eventually came out, but that was really only after he was put on trial, where he wrote a kind of so-called confession, where he told all about the methods and why he did it. But he was exposed. He was such a brilliant forger that at no point did they think, oh, these might not be genuine. I mean, they had genuine letters by Joseph Smith, and Mark Hoffman's Joseph Smith letter was every bit as exactly the same, the handwriting, the paper, everything. He wrote with the left hand, so that was one thing Hoffman had to do, because he was actually naturally right-handed. You know, he could do that. So, but they became suspicious. One bishop called Steve Christensen became suspicious of Mark Hoffman, because by the end of his career, and this is after about almost a decade, Hoffman is living high on the hog. He's spending a lot of money. Curiously enough, he has a passion for antiquarian books. So he's buying first editions of Lord of the Rings for $10,000, racking up a lot of debts. He buys a big house in Salt Lake City, and he can't make enough money to pay all this stuff just from documents and forgeries. And so he can't produce them fast enough either. And so he starts taking money for documents he hasn't even produced, forgeries.
You describe it as a kind of a Ponzi scheme, whereby he's got to pay off his debt, so he keeps on suckering people in who pay him money for documents which he has yet to create, which is extraordinary. The opening of your book, the huge number of chapters at the beginning, is all about Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
And a new poem which he fabricated.
Yeah, Emily Dickinson, fascinating character, sort of has a mythic status in America, this reclusive, beautiful, highly gifted woman. There's almost a kind of cult of Emily Dickinson. And that's also a reason he always chose super famous Mark Twain, etc., Daniel Boone, you know, big, charismatic, iconic American figures. She was one of them. She fitted the bill. And his poem that he wrote, well, it was described by an Emily Dickinson expert as if this was Emily, that it was Emily on a bad day. But it was good enough, because Emily Dickinson, at the time this is situated, in the 1870s, I believe, these sort of little kind of verities, homilies, a bit like a Hallmark card, right? She did write those, and she sent them to children she knew and stuff like that. And so he chose very cleverly exactly around this time period. But what's, you know, mind-boggling, and I really, really concentrated on this document, what's mind-boggling about this document is that he gets everything right. The paper, which he used a particular paper called Congress, he got sheets of that. The handwriting, Emily Dickinson's handwriting was in the process of changing dramatically because she was losing her eyesight. She wrote, for instance, an E forwards and an E backwards sometimes. And these different elements around the time that he situates as forgery, she's writing these different, both of those elements like that. He gets it all right. And so right that the when the poem eventually appears, it's a different story, at a dealer in Las Vegas, of all places. He sends it to authenticate to the world's most famous Emily Dickinson scholar at Yale University, called Franklin. And he looks at it and he goes, well, this has to be genuine because nobody in the world could possibly know this about Emily Dickinson's handwriting except me. He was the expert on her handwriting and paper and everything. What he didn't know, and it's an awful moment of hubris in a way that Hoffman really hurt so many people, awful moment of hubris, because what the professor, the dear professor in Yale, didn't know is that Mark Hoffman in Utah used Franklin's three-volume book on the writing of Emily Dickinson to create his forgery.
to fool him. How did he get involved in murder? I mean, it's one thing to be a chancer, a con man, a forger, and often, what was the name of that painter whose forgeries now command quite a large price because nothing like the original of Old Masters and whatever, but still fetch really fancy prices, even knowing that they're forgeries.
Yes, well, there's a lot of that. People want to believe. People believe what they want to believe. That's something that Hoffman actually said. So they want to believe in these things. They want to believe they've got a new Emily Dickinson poem. They want to believe that they've got a brand new Joseph Smith letter. People want to believe in these things. And he preyed on that very brilliantly. How did he turn to murder? Well, as I was saying, he started spending a lot of money, living high on the hog, and he got himself in a jam. And he was about to be exposed by this Mormon bishop called Steve Christensen. Hoffman had sold him a bunch of documents, including one on papyrus connected with the theology of the Mormon Church, which he had not created. And Christensen started to smell a rat and pushed him to produce this document and one thing and another. And eventually went behind Hoffman's back to another dealer, who Hoffman got the papyrus from in Boston, and realized, this is BS. This is not genuine. He's conning me. And he was about to, he confronted Hoffman. And before he could do anything further, Hoffman built, and this is a sort of where the forger becomes the psychopath. Just as he was brilliant at building forgeries, he created a horrific bomb, a nail bomb, which he left outside Christensen's office. And Christensen picked it up and he was blown to pieces and bits of his brain all over the wall, etc. And then in an act, I think of all the terrible, cynical acts that Hoffman did. And you know, he is very brilliant and he is very fascinating. But he's a evil, evil person. He's an evil genius. And I think the most evil act that he did, which I describe, is that after the death of Christensen, he had to get any suspicion away from Christensen and any connection to him and documents. And what did he do? He discovered that Christensen was in, you remember the S&L loan scandal in America? It was a sort of banking fraud scandal. Well, Christensen was in business with a guy called Gary Sheets, who had one of these S&L banks that was under investigation. So what Hoffman then did to deflect suspicion was that he made another bomb, which he placed outside the garage of Gary Sheets's suburban home. But it wasn't picked up by Gary Sheets. It was picked up by his wife, Sharon, and she was blown to bits as well. And
he almost blew himself to bits then, Simon.
Yes, he did.
Was that deliberate to take suspicion away from him, or was he aiming to blow somebody else up and the bomb went off prematurely?
Yeah, there's two views of this. One was that perhaps he realized he was painted himself into a corner and he was going to actually kill himself. And he used to test these things out in the desert in Utah. I'm waiting for the film director to come. I've actually had a few nibbles because it's so scenic and filmic, all of this. But so anyone listening there in Ireland. So he also was about to be exposed another dealer called Brent Ashworth, who'd bought many, many, many of his documents, who was a serious antiquarian manuscript collector in Utah. He'd bought many of them. And he, too, started to get suspicious. And it's believed that the bomb was for him because when it was, he was carrying it in his car, Hoffman, and he put it down too firmly on the floor when he moved his coffee or something. And when it blew up, nearly killing him, he was blown out of the car and was found on the grass. He was not more than 150 yards from Brent Ashworth's, where Brent Ashworth was having a coffee. And at first, people thought, oh, somebody's tried to kill Mark Hoffman. He was the victim, and he played that for a while. But there was a very savvy detective in town who eventually fingered him as the killer. And then the
Where is Mark Hoffman today, Simon?
Well, he was jailed in 1986 for life. At a parole board hearing sometime later, he didn't exactly endear himself to the parole board when he was asked if he felt any remorse. And he said, "I for killing Gary Sheets' wife. And he said, to be honest, I don't. It's just the same as if I'd killed, I felt the same as if I'd killed a cat or a dog." So he was never going to get out of jail ever. And he has not got out of jail. He was at a place called Draper, Utah, which was a sort of fairly high security prison in the desert. I went and visited it. He was then moved recently to another jail out in the Utah sort of, you know, boondocks, a lower security jail. But I think the truth is that he, like all murderers, he has very high status in prison. And because he's weird and brilliant and he runs the prison magazine and the chess club, he's probably in homosexual relationships now, as many prisoners are over long term. And I think probably Hoffman doesn't want to get out of prison. He's found his perfect sort of society, really.
Well, the book is called The Poet and the Murderer, and its author, Simon Worrall, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you, Pat. I really enjoyed it.